This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, MIBiz staff writer Nick Manis explains the dark store's appeal and how some big box retailers are using it to make the case for a lower property tax bill. But first, the State House has adjourned until after Labor Day. That means that no action is expected on road funding or the status of two state lawmakers, Todd Corser and Plainwell Representative Cindy Gamrat, who are caught up in a sex and cover-up scandal until sometime in September at the earliest. Rick Pluta has been following both of these stories closely. He's the managing editor and Capitol Bureau chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick Pluta joins us from Lansing. Thank you for being with us.
Hello, Gordon.
Let's begin by kind of tapping your knowledge as someone who has followed the state capitol very closely for many years. How strange...
Since 1987.
Yes. How strange is this scandal compared to others that you've witnessed?
Well, you know, this would actually be sort of just a garden variety extramarital affair, except for, you know, certainly there's the element of hypocrisy that's part of it, because Cindy Gamrat and Todd Corser have been moralists in the legislature, that they've been very vocal about protecting traditional marriage and make a big deal of following their Christian faith. And also just the fact that, I mean, in some respects, their biggest problem hasn't been, you know, their behavior, the extramarital affair and all of that. I mean, even the cover-up, which is kind of weird because, you know, Todd Corser basically tried to, you know, spread the rumor about much worse things to make this seem, you know, less so in comparison. Although, interestingly, it happens more often on the southeast side of the state than in the Kalamazoo. But it is actually a campaign tactic that, you know, you plaster a neighborhood with brochures with horrible accusations about yourself and then, you know, yell shame at your opponent and hope that it earns you some sympathy. But then the other thing is just one of their staffers recorded some of these conversations. And so this wasn't just, you know, one side said this and the other side said this situation, that there's, you know, evidence existing of it. And so, you know, that's all sort of, you know, ramped it up to, you know, something that a lot of people are talking about. And they are also talking about, you know, either forcing out or expelling Todd Corser and Cindy Gamrat. Although I would argue it's as much for the fact that, you know, they've basically been obnoxious, uncooperative, and are now isolated as much as anything else.
Well, the last lawmaker who was expelled from the legislature was State Senator David Jay, who also didn't get along very well with most of his colleagues in Lansing. Is there a bit of a parallel there?
Well, I mean, he was ultimately removed for behavior that had less to do with his official conduct in office than the way that he behaved outside office, that, you know, there was drunk driving, that there were domestic spats with his fiancée, one of which was captured on a gas station videotape, and some pretty, you know, hostile relationships with staffers regarding stuff he would keep on his computer. And so there's that. I mean, very often, you know, what we find in these instances, you know, we talk about, you know, what makes something a removable offense for a legislator. And, you know, the fact is it's not, you know, a felony involving the public trust or anything like that, but just whatever 2/3 of the House in this instance, or 2/3 of the Senate in the instances of David Jay and, you know, and others, you know, think rises to the level of you no longer ought to be, you know, you no longer ought to be serving here. And we should point out that actual expulsion votes are very rare. You know, under the current Constitution, I think that there's just been one in the House and one in the Senate, at least one instance of the House refusing to seat someone, though, that usually by the time it gets to the point of maybe voting to expel, that the lawmaker makes the decision to just quit and move along, sometimes but not always, as part of a plea bargain.
And often that comes after many of their fellow lawmakers have said, we think it's time for you to go. For those lawmakers who are kind of sitting back and watching this and not directly involved in the scandal itself, how big of a leap is it to publicly say, I think Representative so-and-so or Senator so-and-so should resign, and beginning that process of forcing them out through expulsion?
whenever you're doing this, that a critical part of it is, you know, building the perception of inevitability, which is that, you know, if you're the lawmaker facing pressure to leave for errant or allegedly errant behavior, then you've got to start seeing the votes piling up. You know, the idea that if you don't leave under your own power, then you are going to be forced out. And so, you know, you will have more and more people, you know, maybe coming public about it, you know, also in order to answer questions from constituents. And so, you know, we've seen Republicans in swing districts start to talk more about it. The other big Tea Party Republican in the legislature, Gary Glenn, has said he thinks that they ought to resign. And so, you know, that's part of the pattern of, you know, of how something like this works.
There's been a special select committee created by the House to investigate what they say are the qualifications of Representatives Corser and Gamrat to hold office. Do we know anything beyond that right now?
No, because there is nothing beyond that right now. That this was a committee that was created rather suddenly before the legislature adjourned last Wednesday. And no members have been appointed to it, no chair, no anything like that. The idea was that, well, depending on a report that's going to come out probably this week, that'll allow a committee to get whatever it wants to do in motion should the speaker decide to actually put people on it. I think as much as anything, it was also turning up the heat a little bit on Representatives Gamrat and Corser to, you know, maybe quit sooner rather than later, and also to allow legislators, especially Republican legislators, to show that they have at least done something to start addressing this controversy and scandal.
Assuming that at some point there are members appointed to this committee, whenever there's a high-profile committee in Congress or the state legislature, people really look at, okay, who's on it? What does this tell us about where it's headed? In this case, does that matter a great deal, or have Representatives Corser and Gamrat really isolated themselves from everybody else up there in a way that makes whoever's on this committee probably irrelevant?
I think that's probably two separate questions, Gordon. They have very much isolated themselves, that they don't really have, you know, any friends, which is, you know, one of the problems that when you come into an institution and you start kicking at it and saying that everyone's corrupt, and well, then you find out that when you run into your own brand of trouble that, you know, no one likes you and is ready to help. The bigger question on who might be named to this committee, both Republicans and Democrats, will be, is this a responsibility that you want to assume? You know, is your own closet clean enough that if people start looking into it, that you're not going to be embarrassed for taking on this responsibility? I mean, it's really, it's an ugly, ugly job. You know, in the case of the David Jay expulsion from the state Senate, it was actually assigned to then State Senator Thaddeus McCotter, who, you know, his career ended in its own, you know, type of scandal, you know, many years later. But he came into the legislature as a freshman senator, loudly lobbying against a legislative pay hike that was subsequently scrapped. And so his penance was, guess what? You know, for what you did back then, you now get the job of removing a state senator. Have fun with it.
There have, of course, been allegations of blackmail leveled by Representative Corser. Is that at all complicating this investigation? And is anybody up there taking those allegations seriously?
What Todd Corser is talking about does not seem to rise to at least the legal definition of blackmail, that someone says, look, I know something and it's going to be public if you don't resign, that there was no specific request for money or something else of values trying to compel someone, you know, into a particular course of action. So we will see how that plays out. But no, I don't think that it is. Really, for the legislature, the critical question seems to be, how much staff and other office resources may have been turned to efforts to cover up the extramarital affair. And that seems, you know, without seeing whatever the final work product is going to be of this investigation that's being done by the House Business Office, that seems to be kind of the critical question there.
Again, going back to the fact that you've been watching a lot of these scandals unfold over the years, Rick, how does it normally play out from here? I mean, is the wish amongst House leadership, for instance, they would truly love to see it end in resignation, correct?
Mm-hmm. And the way it almost always plays out is that they resign before they get expelled, sometimes quite late. You know, State Senator Henry Stallings was facing expulsion for, you know, misusing staff and office resources for his art gallery in Detroit. And he resigned literally the morning that the Senate was getting ready to expel him. So, I mean, usually, you know, that they can get pushed out before it reaches that point. But, you know, people seem to be looking particularly at Todd Corser and just not seeing a whole lot of openness to stepping aside.
Is there anything other than saving face that's an advantage of resigning as opposed to expulsion? In other words, you know, pay, benefits, those sort of things?
Well, you can make that part of the part of your exit negotiations. What might happen as far as, you know, pensions, health benefits, you know, things like that. And sometimes, like I said, it's also we've seen this before, that once criminal charges are filed, that it can be part of a plea deal, which, you know, Cindy Gamert has retained a criminal defense attorney. I don't know what kind of legal advice Todd Corser is getting, but it would probably, I'm venturing a guess here, it would probably include don't give up your office until, you know, we're able to, you know, get something for it.
So there were some political observers who were questioning whether this whole Gamrat-Corser scandal was going to make it more difficult to finish a deal on road funding. Of course, the legislature adjourned, no deal on road funding. Did the scandal play any role at all in them not being able to reach a final agreement?
You know, it's hard to say because obviously, you know, the discussions were continuing. And I think in some respects, the vote to even, you know, create this select committee was, you know, partially an effort to show that something got done for, you know, bringing everyone to Lansing for the road deals. But the major effect that it would have is it just, you know, sucks up a lot of the oxygen and the attention and the energy of people while they are trying to come to an agreement on this thing that's been, you know, hanging out for almost 4 years now.
Is there any sort of an outline that we can look at right now and say, here are the basic elements that could lead to some sort of agreement on road funding?
No. Is the short answer, because, you know, everyone that's come up has kind of, you know, fallen apart. There really doesn't seem to be a whole lot of disagreement on how much money is needed, except maybe that even the $1.2, $1.3 billion that they're talking about may not be enough. But, you know, the variables are, what might that money be used for? So part of, you know, the deal making that we saw last week was, you know, maybe they could attract some Detroit lawmakers by allowing more of the city's share of the road funding to be used for mass transit, which is something that, you know, Mayor Duggan and others there really, you know, really, really want to get done. The biggest discussion is how much revenue can we get Republicans, especially House Republicans, to stomach versus cuts. And that means cuts to revenue sharing, to, you know, college, community colleges and universities, you know, to other things that a lot of people care about. You know, how much in cuts can you get the governor's office and other to stomach? And they just haven't been able to, you know, move the pieces around to, you know, get to that point. And, you know, and it's worth noting that, you know, the more money you take out of the general fund and dedicate to roads, that is, it cannot be used for anything else, the more, you know, you limit your capacity to deal with other things that, you know, might come down the pike. And I'm thinking particularly of maybe big legal judgments that come down against the state, and that's happening. And also, you know, natural and environmental disasters that require a huge diversion of resources to be dealt with, which is certainly something that, you know, the Kalamazoo area has been the subject of in recent years.
Is this one case where, because there are a certain number of Republicans who are not going to vote for almost any tax increase
ever?
Yeah, right. Where there are Democrats now who say, hey, we've got a little bit of leverage that we can use because they're going to need some of our votes. And is that why they were pushing, for instance, to take the prevailing wage repeal off the ballot, as reported this past week by the Michigan Public Radio Network?
Well, if you're going to dream, dream big. Yes, that originally, because the Republicans have such a large majority in the House, 60 plus out of 110, there was this idea that maybe they could come up with a Republican-only solution. There's also a substantial two-thirds Republican majority in the state Senate. So there was this idea that maybe we Republicans amongst ourselves can come up with our own solution, so we're making deals with each other and we don't have to make deals with Democrats. And the problem is, every time that revenue number gets bigger, you lose more and more Republicans. And so to meet the numbers that the Snyder administration said were sort of minimally necessary, it became clear that the Republican-only solution was not going to happen. They were going to have to make deals with Democrats. And so the deal making commenced. And so we saw things, you know, like the transportation money for the city of Detroit, maybe some things to help the school district there, which also, could lose you Republican votes. I mean, you know, one of the things is that when you're making deals with Democrats in order to get votes, that you got to make sure that it is a net gain, that you don't make a deal that makes even more Republicans fall off on the other side. So, you know, there's that. But we also saw, you know, there are a couple of retired firefighters, public safety officers in the state house who are Democrats. And so Republican leaders went to them with cancer prevention funds. I mean, you know, really, you know, sort of granular level deal making. You know, we'll see what they, what they have to offer when they come back in September.
Speaking of the Snyder administration, is there a really good sense yet of where the bright line has been drawn by Governor Snyder? Is there a sense that it would be difficult for him to veto anything that reaches his desk? Or has he made it pretty clear that there's got to be a pretty good amount of revenue increase in there if he's going to go along?
Well, two things is that any governor who sends strong signals about what he or she would sign or veto in the midst of negotiations is not a very good negotiator. And so, you know, you wouldn't want to put that out there. But the governor, you know, has made clear that a big chunk of revenue has to be part of it. And, you know, they put the number $800 million on the table, which I think was probably an advancement for them. But he also said that there are some Medicaid problems hanging fire out there that should be dealt with as part of this too. And what they're doing there is inducting some long-term thinking into this, saying that, look, you know, we've got these other budget pressures out there. And so if you're going to shrink the size of the general fund, which is basically, you know, that's the discretionary checkbook, then we'd better make sure that these other problems are dealt with so that they don't come and, you know, shoot a giant hole in what we're doing later on.
Rick Pluta, as always, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, always a pleasure, Gordon.
Rick Pluta is the managing editor and Capital Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick Pluta joined us on Friday from the Michigan Public Radio Network in Lansing.